This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
On Friday, September 22nd, the Norris Group proudly presents its 10th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts will join Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. All proceeds from the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. This event would not be possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: Housing Wire, Coach Fullerton, Coldwell Banker Town & Country, Property Radar, the Apartment Owners Association, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, Invest Club, Las Brisas Escrow, MVT Productions, Inland Empire Real Estate Investment Club, Realty 411, and White House Catering. Visit isurvivedrealestate.com for event information and tickets.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Doug Duncan. Doug is Fannie Mae's Senior Vice President and Chief Economist. He is responsible for providing all forecasts and analysis on the economy, housing, and mortgage markets for Fannie Mae. Duncan also oversees corporate strategy and responsible for strategic research regarding external factors and their potential impact on the company and the housing industry. He serves as the chair of the Fannie Mae Corporate House Price Forecast Committee. Named one of Bloomberg Businessweek's 50 most powerful people in real estate, Duncan is Fannie Mae's source for information and analysis on the external business and economic environment, the implications of change in economic environment to the company's strategy and execution, and forecasting for housing activity, demographics, overall economic activity, and mortgage market activity. Doug, we welcome you back.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
Sounds like a boring job. you got a lot of topics there to cover.
it is actually a lot of fun. It's a broader span of responsibility than most chief economists, so it's a kind of a privilege.
Yeah, that word external factors could encompass a lot of things.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Just in general in the United States, just get your opinion of GDP growth that you expect for the remainder of 2017 and what we did in the first half.
Yeah, we haven't really changed our forecast much for a couple of years. The central forecast is about 2% growth. We've actually bumped our forecast up a little bit to 2.2, partly because the second quarter came in a little stronger than we thought, and it would take a pretty big downturn in either the third or fourth quarter to get it back to that 2%. But we're talking about a decimal point here, so no real acceleration. We are seeing a little acceleration in incomes, but what we're not seeing is that an acceleration in spending. So people are still being quite conservative post-crisis, even though this is now the third longest expansion that we've ever had. People are still being relatively conservative in their financial behavior, yeah, which is not necessarily a bad thing.
No. Is one of those behaviors not pulling equity out of their home?
It is that we've seen a little bit of that, but it's certainly nothing like we saw in the boom. And it seems as though the purposes for the equity extraction are not vacations and things like that, but more of an investment type of thing, putting it back into the house, maybe paying for a kid's college education, something like that. But again, it's nowhere near anything that we saw in the boom.
At a 2% growth rate, what's the likelihood of the Fed aggressively raising the rate?
Well, aggressively is unlikely. They're actually having a significant debate. If you read the minutes of the last Fed meeting, which I assume all of your readers avidly await that, just like all the economists in the world. That's a little economic humor there. But if you read it, reading between the lines, there's a significant debate among the governors about how to think about inflation. And there just isn't support for their classic model-driven view. And a couple of the board members who in the past have been more aligned with the Phillips curve approach to things are backing off of that. So while we still have in our forecast that the Fed will raise rates in December, and we have them starting the runoff of their portfolio in September, I would say the probabilities of that December raise have declined somewhat. There's still several months of data before that, and they will act depending on what happens with the data. But it doesn't look to us like the inflation data is going to be a cause for them to aggressively raise rates. That doesn't mean they won't do it.
Okay. If they do it aggressively, do you think it's in their mind that they have to get it up to a certain level should they need to take it back during a recession?
Well, I think that affects both their thinking on the portfolio and their thinking about the future. As I mentioned, third longest economic expansion we've ever had. At some point, they've all ended. 10 of the last 13, you could argue, were ended by the Fed raising rates when the economy was actually starting to slow. So all of those things will be part of their considerations. Certainly having ammunition, when people use that phrase, they mean enough room, given the current level of interest rates, to cut rates significantly to spur economic activity. They don't have that much room right at the moment, although it depends on what you think the real sustainable growth rate of the economy is. If they believe it's only 1.8 to 2% annually in real terms, then rates are probably not that far from where they would need to be for them to have the ammunition. I'm not in that camp. I think the economy can grow upwards of 3% with the right policies in place, and that would suggest a higher natural rate of interest in the future, and the Fed could go further. But we're not there now. We haven't seen any of those policy changes that would enable that. So they probably don't have that much further to go unless they revert to the purely model-driven perspective that seems to be behind their thinking.
We've got an unemployment rate that's under 4.5 and a 2% GDP growth. Those numbers don't normally go together. So why the lack of GDP growth in this entire, you know, upside that we've had?
Well, I think there's a couple of clues out there that while the administration has not been successful in healthcare reform or tax reform, and we don't think they will be this year, they have been successful on regulatory reform. There's been significant deregulation, especially in the energy sector. And we've had a discussion here about the pickup in business fixed investment. And if you segment it by sector, it's clear that that's taking place in the energy sector. So one of the clues that offers is that regulation is related to the level of real economic activity. And there was a tremendous increase in regulation during the last administration, which certainly has imposed costs and reduced opportunities in the business sector, as made evident by this deregulation we've seen and the rise in investment in the energy sector. So I think that's one of the reasons why growth has been stunted. The second one is there is clear consensus in both parties, really, at least to the parts that are nearest the center, that there needs to be fundamental tax reform. There's lots of argument about how that gets done and what it should contain, but there is actually in Washington a broad consensus that tax reform would be beneficial to growth. And I think also there's no perfect solution to the healthcare issue because there are lots of aspects of the world of healthcare that are not amenable to the kind of free market thinking that it can dominate in the business sector, where people have choice and time to make choice and decisions. So there is. However, a relationship between what is being done in healthcare and what can be done in tax reform, and that's a discussion that's going to continue for some time, and also has a bearing on the pace at which the economy can grow, because the level of healthcare expenditures is quite significant within all of economic activity and is likely to grow significantly given the aging of the boomers.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about demographics and demographics' effect on growth, GDP growth, and inflation.
Yeah, I think that it's clear now, last year, the leading edge households of the boomers turned 70. That was in 2016. And that's the year in which, if you delay Social Security receipts, that's the year in which you can maximize your Social Security return. So now you are seeing the full retirement benefit draw of the boomers going forward. The boomers were also the group who, in the early stages of the recovery from the severe recession, saw the most significant increase in workforce participation, which suggested to us that they're not going back to work to spend the money. They're going back to work because they're worried about their retirement. Correct. And that continues to be true. They're saving for retirement. Saving rates have been up. They've actually slowed somewhat recently because asset valuations, both in stock portfolios and in homes, have risen back to levels that they were at the end of the boom. But consumption hasn't picked up from there, which suggests that those households are not going to consume out of the expectation that wealth was sustainable, a mistake that they made pre-meltdown. So we expect that what all that means is that the millennials have to step in, and they clearly are. If you look at, in particular, the housing data, and we've talked about this before, our surveys of millennials said, well, they eventually want to own a home, but they have to have a job, and that job has to have a sustainable income. Then they're going to get married and have kids, and then they're going to buy houses. So we actually have some data where we track specific millennials, and that they're doing exactly what they said. They're now the driver in the home purchase area. The problem is that lots of those initial jobs for millennials were in markets where you simply couldn't build single-family homes profitably. So now we have sort of a supply problem because the boomers are aging in place, which is they've been saying they're going to do. The job growth for the millennials have been in some of those same places. So there's a real supply problem in that there's a low level of turnover of existing homes and a low level of construction of new homes. So one of the drivers of inflation, to tie it to your question about inflation, is the housing component, which is the largest component of the CPI measurement. Mm-hmm. And that has been growing at significantly faster than the rest of the core. But in our view, it's driven by the supply problem, which is why when we've talked to the Fed over the last 2 or 3 years, the consistent question from the Fed leadership is, what's wrong with the housing supply function? And that tells me that they're thinking that housing's contribution may be overstated in the way the CPI measures it, because it's actually a market structure question, not a price level shift. So that may keep them a little more patient on raising rates than you might otherwise have seen.
These millennials that are maybe wanting now to own a home, if they're parked in a state, let's say they're in California, they literally can't afford the payment. Does that drive them to migrate somewhere else? Is that becoming more common?
The answer to that's clearly yes. And businesses recognize that given the prices that they can charge for products that they produce and the amount of labor that's required to produce those products, if the price of labor is too high because of the affordability of housing, they will move their business. And you've started to see businesses migrate out of high-cost markets into lower-cost markets. And so that's part of the reason that you can see the millennials now starting to actively drive the demand curve, but it's not, but it's much broader geographically than it was initially because businesses are relocating so they can afford the labor force to allow them to produce and sell their products profitably. That we've predicted that. We didn't predict particular markets because different kinds of businesses have different directions they might like to go geographically based on what kind of products they produce. But our expectation was you would start to see migration of businesses, particularly where they don't have high fixed costs, into markets where they could afford the labor that could afford houses to live there.
for the average American worker, are their wages rising fast enough to keep up with the expenses?
What's interesting is in the most recent couple of years, that has started to be true in part because inflation is so low. So when you think of things in real terms, actually, the last couple of years, household incomes have performed reasonably well. That's the first, that was not the case for the first, say, 7 years of this recovery, but recently has started to be true. Here's a thought exercise. We've been trying to think through an answer to the question that our CEO asked us, which is it reasonable to expect that the recession will emerge just because the expansion is old? And the answer to that, we think, is no. But they all end. So how could we craft a reasonable story that suggests this might go on still for a while? If you think about the origins of the bubble and its burst, what happened coming out of the dot-com meltdown in 2000 was households moved to investment in real estate more strongly, which started an upward movement in house prices in real terms that was above historical norms and ultimately significantly above historical norms. So if a household observed that rising value of their home, believed it was sustainable, and started to increase consumption by borrowing to our earlier conversation with cash out refis, then that expenditure became sales of products and services to businesses, which increased their profitability and increased their ability to invest in plant and equipment and therefore improve compensation to their workforce. And so wages rose concomitantly. But if that was all based on the assumption that that real estate valuation was stable and persistent, that turned out not to be true.
Mm-hmm.
So they fell significantly. You were one of the folks that was prescient on that front. But if you think about that, then to restore normal relationships, you actually have to reverse that process. How long does it take to reverse that process to get the alignment of wages, asset valuations, consumptions, all back to normal levels? So we had speculated back in the 2011-2012 time period that might be a 10-year process. So if you target the end of the bubble or the start of the downturn at the end of 2006, we're at the end of that 10-year time period now. Now, that is not all worked out empirically, but it seems like a reasonable way to think about things, that there's had to be this reversal of some of those excesses which worked their way through the system before some more normal relationships emerged.
What do you feel fuels the next recession?
Well, typically, there are two or three causes of recessions. One is excessive Fed tightening. A second is financial sector excesses. And a third one is imbalances in production and consumption. So right now, it doesn't look like it's the imbalance in production and consumption, since inventories seem reasonably normal. The Fed will, time will tell whether the Fed acts appropriately or not. But it is still true that domestically and globally, we have the highest, still exceedingly high, in fact, globally, the highest level of debt to GDP that we've ever had. So whether that can be worked off without some sort of a financial down or an economic downturn is an open question. And it gets for the United States Fed, Federal Reserve, to the question of letting their portfolio run off, which we believe they will start to do in September.
Talk about that, because I'm not real clear where it's going to go. So when you say run off of the portfolio, they've amassed a lot of the funding of debt, correct?
Yeah, they've got about $4.5 trillion of assets on their balance sheets, and of course a concomitant level of liabilities. So and about 1.8 trillion of that is mortgage related assets. So what they're doing today is they're, as a treasury security matures or a mortgage backed security matures, they take the principal that matures and reinvest it in another treasury security or mortgage backed security, depending on which matured. When we say they're going to let it run off, it means that they simply won't repurchase another security when the existing security matures. They've been very programmatic in describing, once they start, what they will do. They've set limits on how much they will let run off, over what time period, and how they intend to change the pace of that over time. They've suggested that it will be watching paint dry. I'm skeptical of that, and I wrote a piece not long ago in National Mortgage News just asking the question if it wasn't prudent to consider some potential disruptions in that space. But our expectation is that they will most likely let all of the mortgage-backed securities run off of their portfolio over time, although they may save some small increment since they've built that tool for the conduct of monetary policy. They may hold some in portfolio just to keep the mechanics of that alive. Don't know if that's true. To the extent that they want to make additional investments in their portfolio, that will go back to their traditional investments, which is treasury securities. Now, people are speculating that about how small their portfolio will get. One of the things that they sometimes forget or are unaware of is that the Fed's portfolio has to be the size of the cash outstanding globally. So right now that's some $2.5 trillion, and it will grow as the global economy expands and the dollar, the demand for dollars expands. So it's not going to get smaller than the amount of currency outstanding. That's $2.5 trillion. They also will want some sort of a liquidity reserve to manage the structure of the treasuries that they hold. That might be $500 million. And they have a treasury trading account that they hold as well. So our thought is they may go from that $4.5 trillion down to $3 trillion roughly. It's a guess on our part, but it seems reasonable given the things they have to do and the things that they would probably want to do.
Okay. We've got about 35 seconds left. So impact on interest rates short term when they do that?
In the short run, not much, because the pace is going to be slow. Over time, you would expect that the shift away from mortgage securities to treasuries will increase the spreads between treasuries and mortgages and push mortgage rates up. We think somewhere in the 25 to 40 basis points.
Okay.
So a quarter of a point thereabouts.
Doug, we've run out of time. Once again, we really appreciate you being part of our panel and really look forward to continuing these questions. If you look at my sheet of questions, I got to less than half and I added more questions because of your answers. So,
okay, well, I'm looking forward to it. It's always a great event and I applaud you for holding it.
Thank you very much, Doug. Okay, you take care.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate. First Lending Solutions, Guaranteed Rate and Nathan Chiboya, In a Day Development, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Jennifer Buys Houses, Keller Williams Corona, Keystone CPA, LA South Rhea, Michael Ryan, New Western, North San Diego Real Estate Investors, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, Orange County Investment Club, Pacific Premier Bank, Pasadena Phoebe, Pilot Limousine, Real Wealth Network, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, the San Jose Real Estate Investors Association, San Francisco Bay Real Estate Networking Summit, Sunoco Corporation, South Orange County Real Estate Club, Spinnaker Loans, Think Realty, UDirect IRA Services, West and South Coast Plaza, Wilson Investment Properties, Inc., See isurvivedrealestate.com for event information.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.